today is a continuation of public testimony on the state-operated services reorganization. And we'll begin with Edward Eide and Ron Brandt.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing us to testify this morning. My name is Ed Eide. I'm the Executive Director of the Mental Health Association of Minnesota. I'm going to share information that has been shared with me from people all around the state as an advocacy organization that I feel compelled to do. The state-operated services redesign is significant change, but we have no idea how significant. Is it transformational? We don't know. It was clear from the meetings I attended during this listening process that there was a great deal of frustration around the state in regard to access to services. People had to travel all over the state to visit their loved ones in a faraway facility. People couldn't understand why a nearby CBHH had empty beds, but no one could get in. It appears, listening to testimony here and in other committees, that SOS is a set of services that are not necessarily integrated and that have very few people understand. It is not user-friendly nor recovery-based. It appears often to be simply a holding pen for people no one else wants to serve. Its costs are high per patient, reimbursement is poor, and length of stay is long. Plus, it doesn't generate adequate federal match dollars and has to get its revenue to the general fund instead of return it to its services. It needs to be redesigned, but it needs to be done thoughtfully. Cutting $17 million is not redesign. It is, as Senator Sharon stated, degradation. Two Tuesdays ago, I was in St. James meeting with the Watonwan Local Advisory Council concerning legislative issues. When we got to the SOS redesign, the expressions on people's faces changed. Everyone was very upset about the potential cuts, even though the press release had just been sent out that morning. In the middle of our discussion, a Watonwan County staff person received an email from a peer in Blue Earth County informing her that the Mankato Crisis Program was going to be closed May 5th. Many of the people in the room had worked on developing the crisis center and were mad about the decision. It felt like they wanted to take their anger out on me. It's a good thing Mike Tesner was not in the room. Then on Thursday, I met with the Sherburne County Local Advisory Council. The issue of SOS redesign compared to other legislation, including GAMC, was very tense. Throughout the state, people feel like their ideas were not listened to and decisions had already been made concerning cuts to services. It is not looked upon as transformation, but simply cuts. I received a call last week from a woman, a consumer, who has been following our updates on the SOS plans. She needed some clarification about the cuts and started with the Level 1 trauma centers. She was afraid that the current psych wards will close and be replaced with the new hospitals, leaving people with fewer options. After we resolved that fear, she asked a really great question about metrics and how will we measure the effectiveness of these changes or cuts to services. I thought that was pretty smart of her, and so I told her I would bring my concern about metrics here. We can't have transformation with somehow measuring what's going to be transformed. How will we know if these cuts are implemented that they are successful? Her point is that the redesign should be thoughtful, not a knee-jerk reaction. Her concern was that she understands cost savings and the current deficit are necessary, but what will the long-term impact on people's health be? Transformation is necessary in how we provide mental health services. Recovery and resiliency allows people to be involved with their health care. Better access is critical. Developing partnerships to provide services in local communities are important. I agree with all that. But how do we know this will work? This needs to be a statewide discussion with thoughtful consideration and complete buy-in by anyone. Last week, I also met with the Hennepin County LACs and yesterday with the Dakota County LAC, and tomorrow I go to Rice County. There has been a consistent pattern from all of these groups. Our input was not listened to. The decisions made were already made before the listening sessions happened. It's being done without the participants, both the providers and the consumers. The other piece that's missing that every LAC has shared with me is, and Senator Berglund, you brought this up at the last hearing, this was all about Anoka, all about the beds in Anoka. and Anoka has not been discussed in this plan at all. And that's what every LAC is asking about. What is the impact of Anoka? I think that if we can get Blue Earth County and City of Mankato and the providers there to look at the Mankato Crisis Center and operate that with reimbursements, that's a great model for transformation. It's a great model for funding. It's a great model for keeping services in the community. Thank you very much for allowing us to testify today.
Thank you. Are there questions? Okay, Ron Brand.
I have a written. Good morning. My name is Ron Brand. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. I have a written statement, but I'll just try to hit the high points here. Basically, the community mental health providers are cautiously optimistic about the SOS redesign, and a lot depends on the idea of what they mean by partnerships and how the details of what we're talking about play out in practice. We've had members who have had the opportunity to participate in the various local meetings that have happened around the state. SOS is an important part of the system, but it's just one part of the system. The community behavioral health hospitals serve about 1,600 people annually. Our community mental health centers probably serve 16,000 people with serious mental illness and around 125,000 people in total per year. Regions of the states vary significantly in their priorities and how services would be implemented, how they would be operated, and how the state would relate to them in terms of to the local care systems as a payer versus their role as a provider. There's many pressures that are driving change in SOS, and you've heard about those. There's overspending, there's unallotments, and there's changes in community practice. Currently, the SOS community behavioral health hospitals are operating about half full of capacity, and you've heard that, but why? Arguably, it's because we're seeing the return on investments that we've made by in our legislature, by covering better medications, by providing a better array of services, by having rate increases for critical access providers that allow for care for psychiatrists and better outpatient services, the development of ACT, residential treatment, intensive case management, and crisis services, both mobile and residential. Still, Minnesota's overall spending on inpatient versus outpatient or community services is tilted higher towards inpatient than you would see for national benchmarks, and our use of civil commitment as a gateway to treatment is also higher. There's concerns, very serious concerns, about the interaction of the SOS redesign with the impact of cuts on mental health in the GAMC bill and the proposed governor's budget. Collectively, they total around $50 million in cuts in grants, GMC reimbursements, and aid to counties. These cuts would harm the infrastructure and threaten the viability of very successful programs that currently serve thousands of Minnesotans. It's difficult for me to sleep some nights thinking about the impact of this on real people on the ground. Here are some examples of some of the changes. There's $7.7 million, I believe, cut in the GMC bill that's moving through the process. There's another $9 million in cuts in adult mental health grants in the governor's budget. And there's $12 million cut or so in the related to mental health in the CCSA budget. 10% of county aid, approximately, is used for mental health purposes. And I've talked in a previous testimony about the impact of the GMC cuts, and I list those some in the written piece here. But there's, you know, the largest one is People Incorporated, which has programs here in most of the metro counties, but they're going to lose, just from GMC, they would lose $1.5 million of reimbursements. Of concern is the disconnect between the state's policy and funding role versus the state's provider role in SOS. The general policy direction over the past many years has been directed towards mainstreaming of mental health, covering services through health benefits with wraparound social supports, and focusing on earlier interventions before significant disability, fostering a system of care, coordinated combinations of health and rehab and social services. That's been our direction. SOS proposes to fill gaps in services that result oftentimes from policies and payment methods that can be changed. Let's fix the problems upstream by using some of the funds to update our reimbursement methods to support some of the service activities essential to providing some of the intensive non-residential best practices. The state could enlist community providers to expand their services and earn more third-party revenue and draw down more federal financial participations. For example, there's a moratorium on foster care beds or Rule 36 beds or limits on CADI waivers or changes to PCA. In the Medicaid system, there may be edits for same-day services or no payments for coordination of care or consultation, et cetera. Most states have learned painfully that as they reduce reliance on inpatient and institutional care, that savings really need to be reinvested, and you've struggled hard with this. Unfortunately, it appears as though we're capturing savings as we make changes to the state system. Our members say that they have had some good and bad experiences as partners with SOS. On the positive side, they have worked out agreements for shared staffing on ACT or assertive community treatment teams, on mobile crisis services. They've added SOS staff to enhance or augment services and extend it for more hours or extend it further geographically to serve more people. Community mental health organizations could provide most of the non-hospital services recommended in their report. In fact, some of the community mental health organizations currently manage or operate inpatient mental health or CD units, and many of them provide incentive residential programs. Programs vary, but some are very, very similar to what they just described in the PERTS proposal, and there's nothing in the current funding method that would preclude that from happening. I believe we could create more jobs with changes to the payment methods and better diversification of our revenue sources. SOS has a history of estimating wrong in terms of needs for how many beds we have or developing service models that fit the local needs and whether or not they can develop services that will have the ability to adjust to client needs and requirements and third-party payers is yet to be seen. There are potential efficiencies for shared staffing between residential and outpatient services and inpatient services that would allow for flexibility to increase staff when needed in various programs. Some questions: how would the local partnerships be structured? How would they be financed? What capabilities or competencies would be required? Is it possible to redirect some funds to improve payment methods to get federal match and help enhance the health benefits? We look forward to further opportunity to work with you and the department to address some of these unknowns. I know we can make this work if we're at the table and able to be partners. Thank you very much.
Any questions? Thank you very much. Mary Reagan. And I guess Sue Amberholman.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Mary Reagan. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Council of Child Caring Agencies, a statewide association of providers of treatment services for children and adolescents. Thank you for this opportunity. I'm here today to just express, confusion about the proposal to, again, make changes to the child and adolescent behavioral health services offered by the state. As you recall, the CABS program, as it's known, was transitioned from an appropriation-based program to an enterprise program back in 2002. That really never worked, as you also know. And so last year, it switched back to an appropriation-based program. It's never been clear why it didn't work, and I'm not sure there's been an analysis of why it didn't work. When the decision was made to change the program in Willmar, we offered some input into what their plan was. And we were pleased to see that the children and conditions that they were targeting seemed to be very appropriate, very high-need, complicated children with multiple diagnoses. We were assured at the time that they were very interested in partnering with us, that they hope to really, in partnership, develop a continuum of services that would follow these children into the community so that their care would be seamless to some extent. They also indicated that they would be very interested in working with us to get our staff as well as their staff trained in working with some of these young people. That was all part of an early discussion, and there was never any further communication about it. After the program opened with its new focus, one of the key considerations that I know the department heard from counties, and they also heard from us, was the children that cannot be served very well in the private sector are children who are very aggressive. When the program opened, the new program with the new focus opened, they also were not willing to serve aggressive youth. When we asked about this, we were told that they were not equipped to deal with these youth. This is at a per diem of $1,600 a day. In contrast, in the private sector, our per diems, the average per diem for our mental health certified residential treatment centers is $240 a day. So at least without an analysis, it looks from the outside like a key to the lack of use and the lack of viability of some of this is the cost and the inability to serve the clients that the counties and the rest of the system can't serve. We have a lot of confusion about the new plan, as does everybody. What are PERTs? Who will they serve? How will they be licensed? How will they be paid for? Where will they be located? On Friday, Mr. Tessner described PERTs as less intensive than a hospital, but with intensive therapy services, on-call psychiatry, and weekly psychiatry rounds. That sounds very much like the residential treatment programs that we have in many parts of our state operated by the private sector. What are the new foster care services? As Mr. Brand just indicated, you placed a moratorium on new group foster care licenses last session. How will this be funded? On the children's side, we've been unable to pursue therapeutic foster care funding through medical assistance because it's been delayed repeatedly to help solve the budget problems. We think it's important not to create more state-operated programs, especially those that duplicate or provide a service that could provided more less expensively, more flexibly in the community. Providers are willing to work with stakeholders, including the state, on assessing the need for new services, evaluating who can provide those services in the most cost-effective manner, and in securing a continuum of care across the state, and we look forward to doing that. Thank you.
Are there questions? Senator Erickson-Robes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize for entering a little bit late into your testimony, but were you a part of the stakeholder group that was spoken about before that designed the process and then went around the state talking and having conversations?
Madam Chair, Senator Erickson-Robes, actually we participated in one of the first meetings that was held at the Department of Human Services to set up those focus groups, but we were told at those meetings that there were no plans to change children's services, so that the focus of those groups would not be on children's services at all. So we didn't participate. We made no effort to get people to provide input.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions? Mm-hmm. Okay. Ms. Abderholden.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. My name is Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. It's no secret that NAMI Minnesota, along with all the other mental health organizations, have grave concerns with the SOS report. First of all, we believe it's disingenuous to cut $17 million from the mental health system and call it a transformation. You appropriated $34 million in 2007, which was the largest infusion of new dollars into our mental health system in our state's history. So how can we now cut half of that and say that we're transforming the mental health system? Our mental health system is woefully underfunded, and so cutting $17 million is simply devastating, not transformative. Second, the mental health community is disappointed that the department did not early on embrace and collaborate with the mental health community in their decisions on SOS. Last summer, the department held internal meetings to decide what to do about SOS. It wasn't until October that stakeholder meetings were held, and we received an 8-day notice for the meeting. NAMI then sent a letter to the commissioner on October 15th about the lack of involvement of individuals living with mental illnesses and their families. We then testified to the lack of engagement at a House hearing on November 4th. DHS then finally called a meeting with the mental health community on November 9th. A meeting to plan public input was held on November 19th and then again on December 21st, with the first regional meeting held on January 8th. All the different stakeholders were then invited back to a meeting on February 22nd to review the input from the regional meetings. Throughout all these meetings, we believe DHS has not been able to understand the difference between gathering input and actually collaborating on a redesign. Third, we believe that DHS has not given fair consideration to the input that was provided, and their report offers detail as to what these models are and how they will be funded. SOS administration knew what they wanted to do, and you will see that the recommendation from the internal work group are but for one contained in the final report. I do have a handout for the committee that has a list of the questions developed by the mental health community and a list of the recommendations from the various reports. I'd encourage you to go through and check off which of the recommendations are actually being recommended in the DHS SOS report. I think it will become clear to you that the department made their decisions long before taking public input. If you look at the intensive needs report from last session, you will see that few, if any, of those recommendations were adopted. Both on the children's and adult services side, there is a recognition of the need to address people who have the most intense issues, such as medically complex, aggressive behaviors, and dual disorders such as mental illness, along with developmental disabilities, chemical dependency, or traumatic brain injury. These concerns were also raised at the regional hearings. But the recommendations from the intensive needs report and the community hearings were to create long-term models of providing treatment and services in the community, not in a hospital. SOS is recommending that level one hospitals be created around the state. But where are we going to find the hospitalist psychiatrists to staff this model? We have beds that go empty in the metro area due to the lack of psychiatrists. Why will hospitals want to become level one hospitals when many will be losing money due to the GMC changes? You might even remember us testifying here 2 years ago urging you to not build up the hospital level of care for children or adults because it's the highest cost part of our system and the level that they use for the least amount of time in their lives. People, even with these complex issues, will spend most of their time in the community, and that is where the gap is. Not at the hospital level of care, but in the community where they are going to live for the longest period of time. So what services do we need to develop that will keep them there and not back in the hospital? They also recommend PERT, so they're going to take the nearly empty beds at the CBHHs and make them a PERT. If the CBHHs couldn't take people with medically complex issues or aggressive behaviors, then how can SOS decrease the staffing, put a new name on the program, and now be able to serve these same people? I have asked some of the IRFs providers in the states if the department has contacted them to find out how they run and develop their programs, and so far no one has answered yes. I've been an advocate for people who have used the state system for almost 30 years. I am always nervous when the state builds things because once they build it, they want to operate it forever, even if its usefulness has ended. This was definitely true for the institutions, and now it's true for the CBHHs. The state has these empty beds, and so now they're just going to keep renaming them. The problem is that if your system is so inflexible that it can't work with others in the community and cannot change quickly to meet the needs of the community, it's doomed to failure. SOS has to be part of the system, not the system. There is nothing in this report that assures us that the problems with the CBHHs having empty beds won't be repeated over and over again. There is also nothing in this report that holds SOS responsible for its budget, so their history of overspending and underserving won't happen again. NAMI would like to know how much was projected to be generated from the CBHHs and how much was actually generated. NAMI would like to know why Anoka, which actually has a waiting list, is only able to fill and staff 157 of their 200 beds. NAMI would like to know why the Mankato Crisis Center has served as much or more people in its center than all the CBHHs combined, but yet is slated for closure. As one of our board members stated last week, it's a bureaucratic shuffleboard, a kind of take care of us before we can take care of them. One of the elephants in the room is, what is the role of state-operated services? It used to be the only game in town, and now it's a third of the funding and even less in terms of the people served. So what is the role? Shouldn't there have been some agreement on that before doing a transformation? Is SOS a safety net to provide treatment and services to those individuals that are not served by the community providers, either because they can't or they aren't paid enough to do so, or is it a specialized health system that operates in its own silo? There has not been a discussion or agreement on this point between the department and the mental health community or even the legislature. We think that there should be. We are also puzzled by the lack of recommendations on Anoka. I have been contacted by several staff, and I want to mention that it is not Dave Hartford since he's on my board. I don't want to get him in any trouble. It was other staff at Anoka as late as last night who stated that last spring they had started collecting and analyzing data about problems and barriers to discharge, and I actually have copies of the documents that they put together. And they've been developing their own ideas about what they think could be done and how to work with the counties. As of last night, they said they had not been contacted. The recommendations you see were not developed with the mental health community, but by certain SOS staff and consultants from other states. Two of the consultants are psychiatrists, which maybe explains the focus on providing psychiatric care, and they're from states that don't have strong county governments, Vermont, a very tiny state the size of St. Louis, Lake, and Cook counties combined, and Massachusetts, where they really don't have a shortage of psychiatrists. SOS, in some ways, has proposed a very medical model, and while we believe we do need to treat mental illness as a regular illness, we also need to develop those long-term supports in the community where people spend most of their lives. I'll remind members that the mental health community was able to develop the 2007 Mental Health Initiative without the help of out-of-state consultants. DHS needs to have all of us at the table deciding what to do, not just people from other states who have no history or true understanding of how things work in Minnesota. In closing, we, the mental health community, are greatly disappointed with the SOS report and have no faith that this plan will be successful. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Are there any questions? Okay. If not, thank you. Barb Jacobson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'm here to speak. My name's Barb Jacobson from ARM. Prior to working for ARM, was a provider of services to people with disabilities for 22 years, and I want to speak briefly about my concern about the elimination of dental services as a state-operated service. Many of our most challenging individuals find it very difficult to find dental services in the community, and our state-operated services are those services for which where they need to go. It's sometimes driving up to an hour and a half or more in order to get those services. These services provide a good spot for people who have behavioral issues or just a great fear of the dentist, and oftentimes community dentists aren't willing to accept them as patients because of MA funding or because of the disruption they might cause to their office. My concern is if these services are not available to them, the alternative for some of these people is to be put under general anesthesia in order to have dental work done. And obviously this is a fairly intrusive way to have dental work done. Also, one of the things as a provider, oftentimes significant behaviors are directly related to untreated or unknown dental issues, and a reduction of services for these folks would be extremely challenging to those folks living in group home situations where their behaviors escalate to a point of maybe even needing an alternative placement just because of that. So thank you, and I take any questions.
Are there any questions? No, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Sulik, I see you're with us today. I just have a couple more questions for you if you want to come up to the table.
Morning.
Morning. So I'm sure you heard about how angry I am that you didn't do what you were told to do with Anoka.
We have heard and we understand that there's a lot of there's a lot more details that need to be ironed out and explained regarding the Anoka plan. So, and we're certainly prepared to do that, Madam Chair. It's just really important to understand the message that I think Mr. Tesner was trying to communicate last Friday and that I was last Tuesday is that plan, the idea of taking Anoka and transforming it into these various levels of care across the metro community requires a tremendous more amount of input from the community stakeholders within the metro region. And that needs to happen from this point on out. That was not able to be completed in time for this report to be released. But that is clear, and I think we've been very clear about that is the intention, that framework of level one, level two, and PERT levels of care in an integrated manner with our community hospitals that are currently in the Twin Cities metro area, that is clearly part of the intention.
Dr. Sulik, the law asked you to do that between the time the session ended and January 1st.
We understand that, Madam Chair.
And if it had been done, and if we were on our way to implementing what you were asked to do, we'd be 700,000 closer to the goal you have rather than only 200,000 closer and moving people to another part of the state where most of the workers aren't going to be able to relocate.
Well, Madam Chair, essentially what the entire all the staff that have been involved in this process have really attempted to do is go through the exercise of obtaining a tremendous amount of stakeholder input, as we've clearly outlined. Now, it would be a lot easier. You just heard Sue Abderholden talk about the importance of obtaining input. That effort has been made far greater than anybody ever could have imagined that we would try to take on in such a short period of time. We can be criticized for taking that on and trying to obtain all the input we could and trying to synthesize that information as meaningful as possible. And we can be criticized for taking too long in the process and not coming to more details. You know, essentially, we have made a very good attempt, and there's been a tremendous amount of people working on this, to take as much information from around the state as we can. What I did say on Tuesday when I testified is Anoka cannot be seen as existing in a vacuum, and there is an opportunity to truly learn from what was not working with the utilization of our community behavioral health hospital beds. We simply did not want to replicate the community behavioral health hospital model in the metro region, because we have 6 community behavioral health hospitals that were never certified. And so I fully understand there's a lot of angst.
Dr. Sulik, that is never what we talked about. We never talked about creating those kind of hospitals in the metropolitan area as a part of the restructuring of Anoka. We talked about IRTs. We talked about intensive residential with intensive outpatient treatment. We never talked about community hospital beds.
But we talked about community beds, but we talked about them being, as Madam Chair, as we indicated, at various levels of care, at a different level of care than a hospital. I mean, that is, and what we're hearing is that there still needs to be better clarity to what a PERT level of care really is and compared to an IRT. Yet, at the same time, when we've presented the locus data from Anoka Regional Treatment Center, that information's been presented not only internally but across the state, and there is a subset of people that clearly need a level of care that does not appear to be currently available in our current system. And that is these individuals that are more complex, that need a longer length of stay for stabilization, but don't need to be in an acute inpatient psychiatric setting. You know, one of the things we don't want to replicate is, as Mary Regan just presented, the difference in the cost of care per day at the CABS unit, as an example, compared to a residential level of treatment, you know, is well over $1,200 to $1,300 difference in cost. Well, one of the things that we need to make sure that we're doing is matching the right level of care to the individual's needs and doing so in as meaningful manner as possible. It feels like 9 months is a long period of time to be taking this on. I think we're much further along than we thought we could be 9 months ago.
The only reason that it's a long period of time is because you've left us such a short period of time to react or to change your plan.
Madam Chair, there's essentially, because of the budget pressures, there were very few items that were clearly indicated in this plan that have to occur very rapidly because of the budgetary pressures. And we all know that redesigning Anoka is not the only thing that has occurred to put pressures on state-operated services, which is why this was not taken on in a vacuum. It is what it is. We had that $17 million of accrued pressures that I explained on Tuesday, what constitutes those $17 million, which is why just focusing on Anoka was not able to occur. And I
might agree with you, but to ignore Anoka was not warranted when we passed a state law that was signed by the governor.
Madam Chair, it is our impression that the report attempted to outline what an Anoka redesign process, what Anoka redesign could look like in the metro region with these various levels of care, but indicated that a next step is clearly necessary, and that is to engage the community stakeholders within the metro region specifically around these types of partnerships that could occur. We can't speak for our community partners. We can't say that they will come to the table and partner. We've indicated clearly that our hospitals need to be assured that the risk is not falling completely on them. That still needs to get worked out, and we have every intention to attempt to do that.
Dr. Sulik, with all due respect, the bill that was passed went through the committee process and had testimony. given to the legislature. So, you know, when we go through a public process like that and we pass legislation, it isn't okay for the state agency to say, oh, well, we think maybe we need longer to do it, or, oh, well, we had something else we had to do first. It isn't okay. Do you understand that?
Madam Chair, we understand that. And it's my impression that we've been communicating the additional pressures that are upon us, then, and we've been keeping your office informed of the fact that we were not able to just take the Anoka redesign on because of all the other...
I would agree with that, but I had the impression it would at least be in your plan. And as far as I can see, it's not.
Again, I recognize that the report was done at a high level and speaking about concepts, and what is left to be ironed out in detail is the how. How can this really occur? And that is clearly what I attempted to start that process explaining on Tuesday when I was here last week. And Mr. Tesner attempted to explain that there is every intention to be engaging people specifically in these action work groups to get us to the level of implementation and detail that could work for our stakeholders, and not to do this in an isolated manner, not to do this in a manner in which partners are not at the table with us.
There's no savings identified in your plan for doing the things the law asked you to do.
Madam Chair, in going back to the Anoka redesign call, there was a request for $700,000 savings in this biennium with a significant increase in savings in the next biennium. And it was clearly outlined that in phase two, the Anoka redesign through partnerships would be occurring during the phase two, which begins now and lasts 15 months. So that by the end of this 15-month period, that there is every intention to have moved into formal partnerships across the metro area. Now, does that mean that a unit would be operated by another provider at Anoka, or does that mean that a unit would be operated in another hospital using state employees? Those are the permutations of partnership models that we have to explore. The reason we have outside consultants is because these individuals are well aware of all the array of those type of partnerships that have been occurring across the country, and it's our intention to try to learn from them as best as we can. We'd be criticized if we didn't bring consultants in, thinking that we were the experts, which we're not. You know, we have to be obtaining as much information as we can to see what's worked elsewhere and see what can work possibly for us.
Dr. Sulik, we've asked for all the financial working papers in regard to this plan. We asked for them over a week ago. When will we receive them?
Yeah, it's my understanding, Madam Chair, that Shirley Jacobson has been working diligently on preparing very detailed information for you. My understanding will be getting that as soon as that is ready for you. But she's working on that live today and has been for the last week.
I'm a little bit confused as to why anybody needs to work on it. If you were working on it and using it.
Madam Chair, I think that some of the questions that she's been presented are she's trying to be very specific for you in regards to the questions that you were given, that she received from you. So it's my understanding that she's working on that. And it's very much a lot of the information that we have and we've been thinking through, but she's trying to give you a level of detail that you've asked for.
Well, we've asked some questions, but we've also asked for the financial working papers that you've used. And I wouldn't think you'd have to work them over before you gave them to us.
Madam Chair, all I can say is I can ask. I can ask where those are, because I don't know why that those haven't been given yet, other than probably one, give you the entire package so that you can, it's understandable for you. We've been trying to present to you the thinking behind everything that's been said and proposed and presented and why. We don't expect everybody to like it. We don't expect everybody to like the fact that there's all these array of pressures that have been going on. Things could have been done differently if all of these different pressures weren't occurring at the same time. We do believe that this is a proposal to have state-operated services move into a completely different place than ever before in an integrated, partnered manner across the state with community providers. There is some experience in that, as you heard Mr. Brand say, that there have been models of community mental health centers and state-operated services partnering to provide a different type of care.
So, Dr.
We want to
Selig,
move into that.
My question was, when will we get it?
Madam Chair, as soon as I leave here, I'll ask Shirley Jacobson that question, and we'll get that information to you today.
Dr. Sulik, what are you going to do if we are not able to remove the no layoff language from the statute? What is Plan B then?
Well, Madam Chair, it's my understanding that the bargaining units and Mr. Tesner and others have been having conversations about options that there are there. That is a significant pressure, given the entire array of targets that we have to accomplish in this next biennium. And so looking at, again, one of the things that is in that proposal is, are there models where we can be contracted with hospital systems to be moving into a shared unit where the contract, there's an opportunity to share in the appropriation in a way that the state employees are contracted out to the hospital system at a significant reduction in the rate that they would have to pay themselves. Those are the models that have been discussed. However, we don't know that those will be accepted by partners, which is why that level of detail hasn't been presented as of yet. Because we need to know if a hospital would be willing to come to the table. We've had conversations with smaller hospitals about that level of detail, and there's interest. The question is that a model that could work systematically across the whole state for everybody? We don't know that yet without having those detailed questions.
We would like to know what the plan is if that language is not able to be appealed. What will happen with Anoka then, and what will happen with NITO then? If you could please tell us that. Not right now necessarily, but in the next day or so.
I understand. We'll get you a response to that question, Madam Chair.
I guess the other concern is, what if the state plan amendments are not approved? Or the timing of what you think will take to get the state plan amendments approved.
Correct. Madam Chair, the one reason that we had a consultant ongoing in this process with us from SAMHSA was to help advise us to make sure that we were on track with something that was plausible and that would be acceptable at the federal level. And right now we have every indication that says that we're on track, so that the holdup at this point is the process, but we believe that as aggressive as that process can occur, we should get there. If the amendments to the state plan are not accepted at the federal level, then we need to rethink that strategy of that PERT level of care. It is the PERT level of care in which that's going to require the amendment. And as you've heard, that PERT level of care would help some of our community providers as well. I just visited Hibbing Hospital on Thursday, and they have a model that is essentially they have an extended unit in the hospital that is ongoing medical monitoring. It's a transitional step-down unit from their acute unit, and that's a model that works. The state, our department has been subsidizing that program for the last several years, and there seems like there's some effectiveness in that model. But we're subsidizing that program. It has not been built into the state plan to fund that through federal dollars, which is what we're attempting to do. So I believe that we're on track with the federal plan and amending the state plan. We're going to have to come back to the table if that's not able to move forward in the way that we believe it can, and we're willing to do that.
Senator Coring?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I don't really have a question, just kind of a frustration. You know, in the 8 years that I've been here, a lot of times have had different problems with different agencies, and I always, a lot of times I tell my constituents that I and other legislators are not really steering the ship. I said it's usually the bureaucrats that are kind of steering the ship, and this is a prime example of what I've said over the last 8 years of the legislature and the governor passing a law and the people at various departments not following the law. And I got to tell you, Dr. Sulik, I feel frustrated, like I'm wasting my time here. I really do. And it's frustrating. And I will say that, and don't take this the wrong way, but you are a great talker. I mean, you're talking, and I just, but I'm not hearing what I'd like to hear. So I just wish the departments would realize that we are the voice of the people, and what we pass here, you're supposed to implement. Not what you want to do, but what we tell you to do. That's the way it works. And I'm just really frustrated about this whole thing. So.
Senator Sharon?
Thank you, Senator Berglund. I'm not going to... I am going to say that, as you know, the crisis center in Mankato is slated to close in May. And that crisis center was a part of an overall redesign plan and the closure of a number of inpatient hospital beds at the regional treatment center, and was a collaboration and a partnership established with many providers in the area. It is a collaborative. It is a part of what you're describing as wanting to occur in your redesign. And yet, without really any heads up or any planning for how to truly deal with what happens when that's eliminated, we are left with what will create a crisis in our region, not just in Mankato. This is a regional facility because we're accustomed to collaborations between a number of providers and hospitals in the region. So I'm not going to go on and say that they didn't get too much about what you already heard about how much participation in the solution, not into what the needs are, but into the solution for dealing with this, that there is a group that is offering an alternative to try to help us limp through this process. And I want to know if you're open to that, and do you plan to participate in meetings this week to try to offer an alternative to help this community until the long-term vision that you're talking about is better understood and planned for?
Yeah, Madam Chair.
I'll
respond to both comments, if I may. First, Senator Sharon, I just received a proposal late last night that I just reviewed this morning, skimmed it last night, read through it this morning. We're very open to opportunities to collaborate and try to solve this. That's why we've been out there. That's why we've been out meeting across the state. So certainly, and that's one of the things that was indicated, again, as I said on Tuesday, decisions that were made about that had to be made about implementing something immediately because of the magnitude of the budget deficit for state-operated services had to be done in such a way that there was thoughtfulness around where services that would be removed from one program could be taken up by others in that region, by the state-operated services in that region. And the reason the Mankato Crisis Center was identified was because of the St. Peter Community Behavioral Health Center, essentially 10 miles up the road. And so I recognize that that's not the perfect plan. If there's alternatives, as I've read through this, there may be some alternatives here that we can work with, and we're certainly willing to have that conversation. We're having the same conversation in Eveleth as the communities have reeled together and tried to figure out, okay, how can we come up with a counterproposal that may be able to work? We still have the budget deficit we gotta address. It is what it is, and I appreciate that. But I also appreciate the fact that people are willing to come to the table to try to help work with us to solve this. And that's again, I'm just saying that we're very open to that, and I'm certainly will be at any meetings that people are requesting to have. In response to Senator Coring's comments, I appreciate feeling frustrated that this doesn't seem to have a level of detail. That's what I'm hearing. I'm hearing a lot of anxiety, not just amongst the committee members here, but also amongst the advocacy groups and other people that have communicated. People want more detail. Yet I also recognize if we came forward and just presented an incredible level of detail, people would feel anxious about the fact that all the decisions had been made already without their opportunities for input. I'm not sure when you're saying that it feels as if the department is doing this independent of you all, what's behind, I mean, what you would like to see us do differently. Because, I mean, again, we have
been
here. You
will see shortly.
We've been here wanting input and wanting feedback. And we've been asking for input and feedback and engagement continuously in this whole process. But I'm asking you that question, what you would like to see being done differently that you feel would be more positive, that you feel would be helpful in this process.
When you see it, we hope you'll be willing to work with us on it.
Madam Chair.
That's what I offered.
Just a second. The numbers that appear on the Phase 1 projected savings and FTE impact, do those amounts reflect program, state plan changes, or just the elimination of FTEs?
And this is on which slide that you're referring to?
32, page number 32.
Those are
it's in your book in the front.
Right.
Numbers.
When that particular slide has the projected savings, those are net savings that were calculated after reinvestments and moving of staff, et cetera, were taken into account. So what is presented here is projected net savings as a result of those changes. The potential full-time equivalents impacted is total full-time equivalents impacted. What is presented in that column is there were 26 full-time equivalents, for instance, at the closing of the CBH in Cold Spring. The projected savings as a result, net savings after layoff costs and everything, is what constitutes the $3 million in savings. The cost of a community behavioral health hospital is much higher than $3 million. That's why that figure is $3 million, because the net was calculated by Shirley Jacobson in that process. So what it sounds like would be helpful to you is the more details around each of the net calculations. So
well, I mean, that's why we've asked for all your financial working papers.
I understand.
Moratorium on licensure was raised by one of the witnesses who testified today. Is that going to be a problem in regard to any of the things that you've laid out for us in terms of the plan?
According to our MSOX program, there are beds that they have licensed in their licensure that could be shifted to make available the transitional therapeutic licensure beds that have been proposed so far, and that's what's being examined right now. But apparently there is MSOX has some licensing for some of these type of levels of care that are being proposed that was created, for instance, at the Pillager home.
So could you get us that information also?
We certainly will.
And then the Federal Health Care Reform Bill has some language in it that I wrote a letter at one time supporting to allow pilots for IMDs for both public and privately operated programs. Do you have any idea what that will do to impact the plan or the services that you provide?
Madam Chair, when I saw that language originally in the plan, and I haven't looked at the details since the passing of the bill Sunday, but what that language originally proposed, increasing the 16-bed limit to a range of 20 to 25, depending on which bill that language was being referred to, and not doing it globally, but then assigning to various states that a pilot to be able to attempt that. With that language being in that bill, there is a possibility that that could really significantly help us as we move towards this partnered model of care, but not restrict ourselves to a certain the limitation of a 16-bed size. So there's potential there. We don't have the details of it yet.
And what type of federal funding do you think that pilot could bring?
Well, it would do two things for us that I could see. One is that it would allow a program to be meeting federal requirements for CMS certification and not have to be restricted to 16 beds. And the second is by participating at the pilot level that our opportunities to get certification are significantly greater than trying to do it as we have for the last 4 years independently. So I think it potentially could open a nice door to move that process forward. again, the reason that the community behavioral health hospitals.
You don't have any idea how many are going to be allowed to be in a pilot or how many beds we might be able to draw down FFP on.
Correct. I have a call actually into William Hudock from SAMHSA when I saw that to see if he could give me some more specific information, if SAMHSA has any information yet. I haven't received that information yet, but we've put a call in asking for that.
When you get that, if you could let us have that information also, that would be helpful. Other questions, Senator Lynch?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Sulik, I just I heard you talk a number of times about engagement and stakeholders and input, and we did hear lots of testimony from various stakeholders on the proposal that you've brought forth, and I know that particularly with regard to Phase 1, there are communities that are impacted in Phase 1 that were never a part of that process. We're never a part of that process. I think that's problematic. And I just mentioned that so that going forward, perhaps that can be rectified. I think particularly in the situation in Mankato that there are some opportunities to look at some different funding mechanisms that I hope are being pursued. And I think particularly the testimony from Eveleth was very compelling in that when you talk about collaboration and partnership, there are some unique circumstances there that I know Mr. Tesner was apprised of and would like some assurance, particularly in those two instances, that you are revisiting those areas in your decision making.
Any other questions? If not, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We will move on to the rest of our agenda then. Senator Pretner Solon, Senate File 525.
Madam Chair and members, Senate File 525 is a bill that regulates body art establishments and artists in Minnesota. This bill was heard and passed the Health, Housing, and Family Security Committee as well as the Commerce and Consumer Protection Committee last year. It's a bill, actually, that we've been working on for a number of years. It was heard in this division as well, and the result last year was a provision in the Omnibus Health and Human Services bill requiring the Department of Health to conduct a study on current body art establishments and procedures. I have the A4 delete everything amendment before you, and this is the result of the department's recommendations as well as various stakeholder meetings. Similar language was recently passed in the state of Wisconsin also. So I'd like to offer the A4 amendment, and then I'll tell you what it does.
So we have an A5 amendment.
No. A4 is in your packet.
A4 is in the packet?
Yeah.
A5 is technical. Oh, and I'm kind of wondering why an A5 is being distributed.
It's actually, the A5 will come later. It relates to the fiscal note.
Okay. So Senator Pretner Solon moves the A4 amendment. Any discussion?
I can walk through that with you if you like.
If you would. This is not.
This amendment adds a few other procedures to the definition of body piercing, such as branding, scarification, suspension. I don't even know what these are. Subdermal, microdermal, and tongue bifurcation, which are all currently being done in Minnesota. The amendment simplifies the establishment licensing process. Information on the establishment is submitted to and reviewed by the department. The department then conducts an on-site inspection of the establishment, and upon approval from the commissioner, the establishment will receive a 3-year license. Additionally, the amendment creates a specific technician license for both tattoo artists and body piercing technicians, as well as a dual license for those who do both. There is no longer an apprenticeship requirement, but the amendment does require the applicant to complete at least 200 hours of supervised experience and requires the applicant to apply for a temporary license during the accumulation of these 200 hours. Following the experience requirement and completing the required coursework, the commissioner will issue a regular technician license, which is valid for 2 years. There is also a grandfathering or grandparenting period until January 1st, 2012, when the 200-hour requirement is waived if the applicant can prove that they have performed at least 2,080 hours of body artwork within the last 5 years. And finally, the amendment stipulates that a technician cannot tattoo anyone under the age of 18, regardless of parental consent, nor can the technician perform branding, scarification, suspension, subdermal implantation, microdermal, or tongue bifurcation procedure on those under 18. Limited body piercing may be performed on someone under the age of 18 as long as the parental consent requirements laid out in the amendment are followed, and that states that they have to be, for just very few procedures, have to that has to be signed in the presence of the body art technician. And why this was so important is that it was interfering with our blood supply in the state, as well as for consumer protection. But anybody who was getting tattoos or body piercing in our state in an unlicensed facility was not then able to donate blood for 12 months. As long as we regulate the technicians and the facilities, that means that they will be able to meet the standard to participate in donating blood. And so this bill is supported by the Red Cross as well as the Memorial Blood Centers. And we've not heard of any opposition from the industry with the bill as it's amended today. As I said, we work very hard with the stakeholders to bring this together. And so I'm happy to stand for questions. I have with me Steve Spigum, the former Speaker of the House and Commissioner of Labor and Industry, who's on the board of the Red Cross, and Vic Moore, who's also here to speak on the bill.
Well, let's see if there are any questions about the amendment first. No? Then those in favor of the A4 amendment say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Gentlemen, did you each have anything to say, or are you here to answer questions? Or,
Madam Chair, I'm Vic Moore. It's up to you, Madam Chair. We could answer questions. I know former Speaker Swigum has a tight schedule and will have to leave, but I'm available to stick around if there are questions. Quite simply, the Red Cross just strongly supports this because of what Senator Prettner-Solon said, the delay in blood donations for a year. This would alleviate that problem, so we strongly support this legislation.
All right. Any questions? Senator Coring.
Madam Chair, I just want to publicly welcome the commissioner to the upper body. And I know after serving a lot of years in the lower body that I'm imagine that you're pretty excited today to be before this committee.
Any other questions?
Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I have a question that I'm just curious about. Okay, on the amendment, it says body piercing does not include the piercing of the outer perimeter or the lobe of the ear. So up here, don't they do that in the mall? I was just curious if that includes the ones up here. Because I have an 18-year-old daughter, and I'd like to know.
Madam Chair, I think I'd have to ask the department to respond to that.
Okay. It's not a big deal. I was just curious if that still was, they did that in the mall.
Well, I think they do it in jewelry stores in the mall.
Well, and Madam Chair, that's why I was kind of wondering, because that's, it doesn't include it, body piercing. So this wouldn't be anything on the ear, is the way I'm reading it, wouldn't be body.
Is that correct, Senator Prettner-Solon?
That's what I think, Madam Chair, but I don't know that for sure. But Mr. Hindemeyer is shaking
his
head.
And Madam Chair, you can tell me later.
I mean, he's nodding and saying that you're accurate.
So the department is indicating from the sidelines, yes. So then I guess the question is, that doesn't affect the blood supply when you pierce parts of the ear?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The the stipulation that you donate blood, not able to donate blood for 12 months, comes from a national standard of the American Association of Blood Banks, and they've exempted the ear piercing from that stipulation. So this legislation with that exemption would still qualify under the AABB standards.
All right. Any other questions?
Madam Chair.
Yes,
Madam
Commissioner.
Chair, not to prolong your meeting, but if I could just, from the Red Cross, thank Senator Solon and the Department of Health, and specifically the tattoo artist professionals in coming together and finding the common ground on this bill. This will enhance our blood supply significantly in the state, a very, very good thing. And, Senator, thank you for carrying the bill and for bringing the stakeholders together in this common ground.
Are there any questions? Okay, well, welcome to our committee. Please come back anytime. you have an A5 amendment then, Senator?
Yes, Madam Chair, if committee members will take a look at the fiscal note. My understanding is that the fiscal note pays for itself in 5 years, which apparently is the goal.
Well, usually it's 4 years.
Thank you. I think I've been told that there is a small surplus in 5 years.
There's what?
A small surplus in 5 years of about $15,000. Was that correct?
Shaking his head.
I'm also getting a nod from the department that that's accurate.
Okay. We don't have fiscal notes that show out that far, so
right.
I guess we just have to assume that this is going to do that. Are there any other questions?
Madam Chair,
Senator Pretner,
I have the A5 amendment. We did have some blanks because we didn't know what the fees would be. And so this inserts the fees that will
right.
work
and
with the fiscal
Ms. Kavanaugh
note.
Has an oral addition or change to the amendment.
Okay.
You want to tell us what
yeah,
that
Madam
is?
Madam Chair, members, on the A5, at the end, after line 12, insert page 17 after line 9, we'd add a section 11 entitled appropriation. $190,000 is appropriated in fiscal year 2011 from the State Government Social Revenue Fund to the Commissioner of Health for the implementation of Chapter 146B, period. These funding shall be $101,000 in fiscal year 2012 and $65,000 in fiscal year 2013, period.
Are there any questions about that addition? If not, we'll incorporate that into Senator Pretner Solon's A5 amendment. Any further discussion of the amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. So, Senator Pretner Solon, I believe now your bill is in shape to go visit Senator Cohen's committee.
So, Madam Chair, I would move that Senate File 525 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to full finance.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. It's been a long journey. I appreciate your patience.
Thanks a lot.
Senator Lori.
Members, I've got Senate File 2974. Senate File 2974 establishes health information exchange oversight. Members are probably aware that in 2009, Congress implemented the High Tech Act intended to encourage the meaningful use of electronic health records. This bill sets up the framework to help with that. It is estimated that Minnesota healthcare providers and hospitals could access between 450 and 800 million of incentive funds through this program.
What the feds are looking for to establish meaningful use is use of a nationally certified electronic health record system, submission of clinical quality measures, and electronic exchange of health information. The first part of the HITECH Act was grants to states. The Minnesota Department of Health did participate in that and was awarded a $9.6 million award, and the charge the Department of Health now has is enabling health information exchange and ensuring appropriate governance and accountability of the framework for this. Toward that goal, between October 2009 and January 2010, the Minnesota eHealth Advisory Committee convened public work groups to develop recommendations on health information exchange and sound practices in five critical domains identified by the Office of the National Coordinator. Those are governance, finance, legal and policy, technical infrastructure, and business and technical operations. This bill really is the legal framework for these to operate in. It addresses making sure that information follows the patient across the full continuum of care. It prevents the fragmentation of health information. It ensures that organizations engaged in health information exchange are adhering to nationally recognized standards. It ensures patient privacy and security, and it ensures that Minnesota has an infrastructure to allow Minnesota providers and hospitals to achieve meaningful use incentives and really make the best use of those federal funding opportunities. Also included in this bill, as we've moved through the process, is making sure that we have a level playing field for health information exchange service providers to make sure that everybody has an equal opportunity to be a provider in this realm. And we do have a couple of amendments that we'll adopt that I'll propose as we move forward in this. I can either offer the first of those amendments now or describe the bill in detail as it stands there.
Well, why don't we get the amendments out on the table and then go through it? I think it might help.
There's an A5 amendment that I believe, I don't know if it's in the packets. No, it's not in the packets. And then there's one that I don't believe is up here yet, but will be before we're done, I would assume. But they're both going toward this leveling the playing field. The A5 that's being passed out right now is in regards to state participation in health information exchange, and it makes sure that health information service providers enter into reciprocal agreements and ensures that those reciprocal agreements provide equal access to information supplied by the agency as necessary for meaningful use by participating entities. And it also, as we traveled through the committee process, the bill as introduced created a health information exchange oversight board that was actually fairly expensive and onerous to operate. And we rethought that whole initiative of creating the board and moved everything to the Department of Health. And folks seemed pretty comfortable with that. And we were able to, one of the concerns that came up was the fees for health information exchange service providers. And by moving these activities under the Department of Health, we were able to reduce the fees for these providers by 30%. So you'll see in the A5 amendment a reduction of each of these fees. And then also the A5 amendment addresses federal funding essentially to the extent that new federal funding opportunities become available. This ensures that, again, all health information exchange providers are on a level playing field to compete for those funds. So these are efforts to ensure a level playing field for providers of health information technology. So that's the A5 amendment. I would move that amendment.
Any questions about the A5 amendment? Seeing none, then those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The A5 amendment is adopted. Senator Lori?
What's that?
Are there other amendments?
One other amendment. I don't know if it's back up here yet. This was an issue. It's being passed out. I'll look forward to seeing it as well. It was
7. I don't know if there's an A6.
There's an A6, but we're not going to offer that. The A7 is language that was agreed to. This is, again, to try to level the playing field, and it's when state agencies interact with health information service providers and make sure that that all providers are treated equally. And the A6, there were some cost issues. It would have cost the agencies to interact in that manner. All of the stakeholders, while I was doing a local option sales tax bill downstairs, got together and came up with whatever this says to accommodate that, making sure that the state treats all actors the same and do so in a way that is fiscally neutral. That is my understanding. I have the Department of Health here to back me up on that, and we could certainly ask questions. But that's the intent of the A7 amendment, so I would offer that amendment as well.
So, Mr. Golden, does the fiscal note that we have for the bill incorporate the amendments?
Madam Chair, committee members, yes. The amendments that Senator Lurie is offering have no fiscal cost to them. And then the fiscal note that you have also incorporates the reduced fees. They're represented in your fiscal note where it says 30% reduced. The fees are reduced by 30%. We provided both of those pieces of information within the fiscal note.
So, Mr. Golden, do we need a fiscal note from DHS? If we do, we don't have one.
Madam Chair, committee members, it's my understanding in conversations with DHS that there are no costs to DHS with the A7 amendment, and there weren't costs for DHS in the bill previously.
Okay. Any further questions on the A7 amendment? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, the amendment is adopted.
We already did. It's in the bill already.
So, Senator Lurie, do you have any other comments or want to go through the bill any further?
I gave you a fairly broad overview of the bill. I mean, it covers most of the relevant aspects. I can step you through section by section. It's up, you know, your call.
Well, you know, we're primarily interested in the fiscal impact. I know there's been work done on the bill, though, so.
Right.
I will ask if there's anyone else that wants to testify on this bill. I don't see anybody. So then, Senator Lurie, I believe your bill would be able to go visit Senator Cohen's committee next.
I will look forward to that visit. I would move that Senate File 2974, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance.
Any further discussion? Seeing none, those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Members, we'll take up Senate File 2702 next, and the fiscal note is being distributed. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, to begin my presentation, I have an A5 amendment.
A5 amendment has been distributed. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, this amendment deals with designating birth centers, which this bill is a licensing bill for birth centers, designating them as essential community providers. And then it provides language so that the Commissioner of Health, in consultation with the Commissioner of Human Services and representatives of licensed birth centers, would evaluate the quality of care and outcomes. And this report would be due by January 15th of 2014. I know that the fiscal note has a cost to the Department of Health for this, but we were hoping that they would absorb that cost. They usually do a report once in a while for us by absorbing it, and we were hoping this one would be absorbed. And then we have some language that just clarifies the bill to make sure that when medical assistance reimbursement is being requested, that we have a licensed professional that would be present at the time of the birth, and that if there are any waivers that are needed, that the department would be authorized to apply for those. And we don't know if the federal health care reform bill has this service becoming a Medicaid service in that bill, but it was in that bill at one point in time. So we're in the event that it's not, then we have the waiver language in the bill. And then we have language in the bill that says that when the department negotiates rates with the prepaid health plans, that would include this service, that they shall take into consideration the lower rates when setting the prepaid health plan rates. And so that is the amendment.
Any questions on the A5? Senator Berglund moves adoption of the A5 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? A5 amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
And Madam Chair and members of the committee, the bill is a bill that would license birth centers. We have a couple that are getting started right now in the state, and we anticipate more would be opening. And the structure of the bill is different than it was last year. The structure of the bill relies on the National Commission for Accreditation of Birth Centers. They have a very rigorous standard that they use for accrediting their birth centers, and so we would be relying on that accreditation, and then the Department of Health would be making sure that that accreditation has been received, and they can ask for any other information that they might want from a birth center, but they don't have to actually go out there and inspect every birth center because this organization does that. And in addition to, you know, not having to reinvent the wheel here, the other additional benefit is lower licensure fees because the Commission for the Accreditation of Birth Centers is a national organization. So all the birth centers in the country help support that organization's operating costs. And so rather than just having a couple of birth centers come online and have to pay huge licensing fees in order to support independent staff in the Department of Health to do what this accreditation process does, this means we would have lower costs within the Department of Health. The bill does provide for a temporary license while birthing center is in the process of meeting the standards that would be required by the Commission of Accreditation of Birth Centers, and that is the process that they use as well. So, birth centers are in the federal health care reform. Thank you. So that's good news. We don't have to probably seek a waiver then, but I think we'll leave that language in here anyway. It doesn't hurt anything. We do also have a fiscal note. We have a map in your packet that shows that Most states in the nation today have birth centers that are licensed, and most of them are licensed through this commission for accreditation process. And I believe we did not get the fiscal note in time for the A5 amendment, so we probably have another amendment that's being worked on to do the appropriations.
All right. I believe Ms. Kavanaugh has that for us. Ms. Kavanaugh.
Madam Chair and members, on the bill, on page 3, line 14, insert $365. And the same on line 15, $365 in the blanks. And then on page 4, after line 19, we need to insert an appropriation section, and this would be a new section. $9,000 is appropriated in fiscal year 2011 from the state government special revenue fund to the Commissioner of Health to implement section 144.615, period. Base funding shall be $7,000 in fiscal year 2012 and $7,000 in fiscal year 2013, period.
Any questions on that?
So I would move that language as an amendment.
Okay. On the oral amendment offered by Senator Berglund, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment is adopted. Senator Berglund.
Okay. There are some folks here to testify.
Okay.
And
all right. We'll welcome Dr. Amy Johnson-Grass to the committee and Cheryl Heitkamp. Welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. Thank you. My name is Cheryl Heitkamp. I'm a certified nurse midwife in the Twin Cities area. Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm testifying on behalf of the American College of Nurse Midwives, Region 5, Chapter 11, and the Minnesota Birth Center and future CNM Birth Center operators. In 1975, the MCA, Maternity Center Association in New York, began as a demonstration project for freestanding birth facilities. Over the past four decades, 200 birth centers have taken root and created a movement that pleases consumers, pocketbooks, and policymakers because of the demonstrated benefits of each category. Birth center care, you'll see in your materials, is as safe as hospital care, is high quality and cost effective. Birth centers demonstrate continued effectiveness by adhering to the highest standards of quality by becoming accredited, which this licensing bill demands. The current state of affairs is that birth centers are operating and may or may not choose to be accredited, but by requiring birth centers to be licensed, the bill requires accreditation, which holds birth centers accountable. We believe there's a long-term benefit because of the high percentage of publicly funded maternity care in our state. I have an additional statement to read from Dr. Steve Calvin, a board-certified OBGYN in the subspecialty of maternal-fetal medicine, practicing for 20 years in the Twin Cities. He says, "I strongly support this bill licensing birth centers in Minnesota. Accredited independent birth centers are a long overdue option for women and babies in Minnesota. For those who choose them, birth centers will provide high-quality, patient-focused care at a reasonable price. I am so convinced of this that a midwife colleague and I plan to open a birth center in Minneapolis across the street from Abbott Northwestern and Children's Hospitals. Minnesota should be a national leader in providing all of the options for pregnancy and birth care. In this state, we already have the best hospital obstetric care provided by excellent nurses and physicians. Our high-tech options are plentiful. Accredited midwife-directed birth centers are demonstrated to be equivalent to hospitals for women with normal pregnancies. Our challenge in Minnesota is to facilitate the use of birth centers so that we have the best of both high-touch and high-tech available. This common-sense birth center licensing bill is the way to make this happen. I urge passage of this bill." Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Heitkamp. We will hear from Dr. Amy Johnson-Grass. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having us here today. My name is Amy Johnson-Grass. I am a licensed and certified professional midwife. I'm also the owner and director of the St. Paul Health Foundation's Family Health and Birth Center. We are currently open and running, and I am here as well today to, you know, offer support for this licensure bill. Everything that Cheryl has said, you know, I just want to reiterate, you know, this bill makes a lot of sense. We're here, you know, as birth center owners and as upcoming birth centers here in the state of Minnesota, truly looking at, you know, safety and quality and standards and wanting to set that, you know, as a basis and as a standard here for the state of Minnesota for birth centers. You know, plus we are also looking to have this be another option for women and families, a true option for women who are looking for, you know, to birth outside of the hospital in a licensed birth center. Thank you.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the witnesses or to Senator Berglund, where do you foresee these, I believe, 10? Are you expecting 10?
Well, that's what's in the fiscal note. I mean, I don't think we really know, but we do believe that there will be more than the two that are starting now over the course of time.
Madam Chair, Senator Burton.
Senator Rosen.
Where do you foresee them? In the metro, in the other hub areas throughout the state, or do you foresee that?
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I actually see them starting throughout the state, not just in the metro area. Wherever there is enough population to produce a revenue stream for a business.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
I sure would like to have one in my area because we need more births, but we don't have any babies coming, so they would probably have to. We need babies.
That's an interesting economic development tool.
Yes. Just need babies. Just build it and they will come kind of concept.
I'll just comment. We heard much about this in the policy division, and there was a really compelling report put together by the Milbank Foundation with regard to birth centers and their utilization across the country. And I am pleased also to see that this was included in the federal reform package.
Oh, well, that's
Senator Rosen.
Yeah, Madam Chair. And then Senator Berglund, that brings me up to, let's see, your original bill, Madam Chair, had the waiver for the CMS, but you...
Oh, it's in the amendment.
It's in the amendment. It's taken care of? Okay. Okay, thank you.
Any further questions from the committee? Senator Berglund?
So, Madam Chair, I'm going to ask something that is a little bit unusual, although it has been done before. I don't usually do it, but this time I am going to request that we send this bill separately and that we lay it over for inclusion in the omnibus bill. We would be carrying the savings in our tracking anyway, but just to make sure that we don't have a problem with those savings down the road, I'd like to move the bill, be recommended to pass to the Finance Committee, and then also reserve the option to include it in the omnibus bill.
On Senator Berglund's motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is Senate File 2336. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and members of the division, this is a bill that amends a law that was passed last year in regard to asthma medical assistance coverage for asthma demonstration projects. And essentially what the bill is asking is that the money can be spent a little bit differently than was originally intended. We were kind of hoping that since there's been so much demonstration in regard to this project and others, of the reduced hospitalization and reduced clinic visits, that we would get a fiscal note that would show savings, but we didn't. But we don't have a fiscal note that shows any cost either, and so it would be my intention today just to send this bill as a separate bill. And we have folks here to talk about the wonderful work that's being done by this project, and...
I think we'd like to welcome Lisa Smestad to the committee. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Lisa Smestad. I'm the Manager of Environmental Services for the City of Minneapolis, and I was the Project Director for the two HUD Healthy Homes grants, which served over 6 years working with asthma patients. And I was asked here today to speak to the cost savings as calculated during our recent grant experience. Previous testimony has discussed the methodology of the grant in reducing asthma exacerbations for our children. The financial information I'm presenting is available in your packets entitled Each Patient-Centered Outcomes. This data was based on 249 children who were followed for 1 year, and the costs of hospitalizations, emergency department visits, and outpatient visits was taken from the Minnesota Council of Health Plans Cost of Better Medicine 2007 report. During our program, we figured that 49 hospitalizations did not happen for these 249 children, with an average of $8,490 per hospitalization visit for a cost savings of $416,010. For emergency room visits, that was based on $945 per emergency room visit, and we figured 71 of those visits didn't happen as a result of our grant program for a saving of $67,000, $67,095. And the outpatient visits for asthma were also reduced by 143 visits at a cost of $192 each for $27,465. There was also children went to school. We figured five more days a school year because of our program, and there were increased reductions in symptoms burdens during the daytime, nighttime, and the functional limitations for these children in their daily life. Okay. Are there questions? Any further questions?
Questions from members?
Senator Berglund? Madam Chair, I think even though we haven't gotten the bureaucracy to catch up with the idea that this program saves money, it does. And so we should be very happy that we funded it and look forward to perhaps being able to fund it in the future. But for now, we're not seeking any more funding, so I would move that Senate File 2336 be recommended to pass.
Okay. And Senator Berglund's motion, Senate File 2336 being recommended to pass. All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The motion is adopted. Thank you, Senator Berglund.
Thank you.
Members, our next meeting is scheduled for Thursday, March 25th, 8:30 a.m. here in 123 at the Capitol. And with that, our meeting is adjourned.
Members, if you have bills that need to travel separately, this is getting close to the end, so please let me know.